We recorded this episode on July 7th, and we did it while self-isolating at our homes because of the novel coronavirus. Many of you may be self-isolating right now, too.
So this may sound a little different from our earlier episodes, and you might hear some background noise that we usually don't have in the studio. But that's part of the new normal that we're all adjusting to as we stay home to help flatten the curve during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Of course, the new coronavirus and COVID-19 are very much on everyone's minds, and Live Science is covering the latest news. You can find updates on our website from across the U.S., from the CDC and the World Health Organization, and from researchers around the world.
But we also hope that by continuing to bring you life's little mysteries, we can all continue to be reminded of the amazing science that's all around us.
Thanks for listening. Keep safe and stay healthy. Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a Senior Writer at Live Science. The world can be a pretty mysterious place, and we at Live Science love to ask and answer questions about mysteries big and small, about ancient civilizations, our planet and solar system, the plants and animals that live alongside us, our bodies and how they work, and technologies that we use every day.
Each episode of this podcast introduces mysterious questions, and we think the answers will really surprise you.
We'll also hear about cutting-edge research in labs and in fieldwork around the world to answer these and other intriguing scientific questions.
In today's episode of Life's Little Mysteries, we're going to dig deep into archaeology, the science of uncovering humanity's mysterious past.
Okay, so Gina, when we talk about archaeology, what does that mean? What is archaeology?
Well, it is, like we said, it's the study of humanity and our past. So basically, anything humans have touched or created is fair game. Anything that can tell us about how humans lived, what was important to them. And so to dig up the past, archaeologists basically look for all the stuff humans left behind.
I do feel like I have to point out because I actually was doing an image search the other day using the term archaeology, and I was seeing all these paleontology pictures. So all these pictures of people digging up dinosaur bones and people, that is not archaeology.
Paleontology is, yes, dinosaurs, not humans.
Right, right. Paleontology, right. It's dinosaurs. It's creatures that lived many, many millions of years before there were humans. So, even though in the photos you may see, you know, dusty looking people wearing hats and work boots, working on a piece of rock with toothbrushes, it's not the same thing.
Exactly. Good point, Mindy. So archaeologists look for humanity's past. So we're looking at tools, dwellings, even our skeletons, anything humans were buried with, monuments we built, food we ate, basically whatever areas that humans called home. Archaeologists are digging into that.
Right. And because different places around the world have different types of climates, there are some places that preserve these signs of the past much more completely in more detail than others do. And there are some places that have, that have sort of really, traditionally or historically been very, rich in terms of preserving archaeological evidence of humanity's past.
And so archaeologists, because it's so broad time-wise and culture-wise and location, that archaeologists often focus on a certain part of the world or specific culture, such as ancient Egypt, China, the Mayan civilization, or they focus on a certain time period within that culture. So an Egyptologist would focus on maybe the Old Kingdom period. And that was, between about 2600 BC and 2150 BC when the huge pyramids at Giza were built, and we'll get to that in a little bit. Or they might focus on the Stone Age, which is a period of time when stone tools were used. And the oldest evidence for stone tools actually dates back 3.4 million years ago in Ethiopia.
So since the study of humanity and our distant past and our origins, this is something that is, is so broad and covers so much time and so many geographic locations. So we thought we'd just touch on maybe some of our favorite archaeological mysteries. And so there are certain parts of the world, there are certain discoveries that are just that have they contain these questions that archaeologists have been trying to unravel for a long time, and in fact are still continuing to try to unravel.
And I think one of my favorite archaeological discoveries, puzzles, mysteries is the Antikythera mechanism.
Oh yes. which is this incredible device. What is it exactly?
So it's 2,000 years old, and it's sort of an analog computer, and it was 1,000 years ahead of its time. Nothing that advanced was found until 1,000 years later. So sponge divers were in the Mediterranean, and they discovered this 2,000-year-old Greek shipwreck, mm-hmm. and the ship sank 2,000 years ago on a voyage from Asia Minor to Rome. And in 1900, these divers found it, and on board, they found 82 pieces now, from which is, you know, this Antikythera mechanism.
These 82 pieces are just for this one thing.
Yes, right. And they're all kinds of pieces, like gears and things. And they, the biggest piece sort of to me looks like a door wheel on a ship, you know, to seal off a door. That's what the front of it, and it's bronze, and it was corroded when it was found.
It almost has a steampunk kind of feel. I mean, obviously, you know, like the steampunk aesthetic is much more Victorian England, but in terms of all of these different gears and all these little parts that fit together for this one giant mechanism to do what exactly? What was it supposed to, what was its function?
So for decades after it was discovered, scientists literally had no idea, because they didn't have the imaging technology to sort of model it, to put the pieces together virtually. Then they realized it's served as some kind of astronomical calculator, because it seems to show a 4-year cycle, which could have been for the Greek games. And those are the Greek games that inspired the Olympics. But some even say actually that it goes back further than the Greeks and goes all the way back to the Babylonians. But that's, no scientist is confirming that. That's just one idea.
Okay. So what were some of these parts that fit together to form some kind of a calculator?
Right. So,
or calendar, calculator, astronomical calculator.
Yeah. Both actually. Okay. Both. So there are 30 intricate bronze gear wheels, and these wheels were used to run a system that shows the date, the sun and the moon positions, lunar phases, even a 19-year calendar, and a 223-month eclipse prediction dial. When they've analyzed it using imaging technology, scientists have found that the five planets that were known at the time are on these dials, or on some of the dials, which was Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. So basically, this is what scientists know so far. And the device is super complex, you know, for its time, and it's still steeped in mystery. You know, scientists don't know exactly who built it, what exactly it was built for, and some have even suggested mistakenly that this Antikythera mechanism was a hoax. It is not, but
it was a hoax. Yeah. Okay, so what, that modern archaeologists put this together to try and fool people,
right?
Or that the ancient Greeks did this as a hoax? That would actually be kind of interesting.
If
they're thinking about 2,000 years in the future, how can we prank people that are going to be looking back at our civilization? I know.
We'll create a...
Let's take a whole bunch of gears.
Yeah, exactly.
And put them together like we're actually using them for something.
I mean, everything was corroded in pieces, this, you know.
Right.
But it makes you think that if we had seen this, you know, if somehow it didn't get cut off in this computer of sorts led, you know, it was advanced upon before 1,000 years beyond it, you know, what might humans know? I don't know. I just think it's a truly incredible discovery, and scientists are still trying to figure out all that it can do.
Well, also one of the things that's interesting about this is, you know, just because it was found in a shipwreck. So without the context of knowing, you know, was this the only device of its kind that existed in the world? Were there other ones that were like it? Were there any prototypes? There's, you know, it's like there's no sense of really where it came from and how it was being used. And you know, in terms of the bigger picture of civilization at that time, which, you know, makes it even more interesting and more incredible.
Yeah, totally. And so, Mindy, do you have any favorite archaeological mysteries?
There's so many. But one of the things about archaeology that's so amazing is that even these really tiny, mundane objects can be, on the one hand, kind of mysterious, but on the other, they can just have these, you know, these, you know, incredibly, they can be representative of these amazingly complex stories. Like something like a coin, right? Which is, I mean, you know, it's like everyone knows what a coin is. You know, there are coins that are being used all over the world today. We wrote about this on Live Science a few months ago. There was a coin that was found in Israel that dates to about 2,000 years ago. And because of the design and the words that were stamped on the coin, it was archaeologists immediately recognized as something that was indicative of a very specific event at that time in history. And it was this revolution led by the Jewish rebel known as Bar Kokhba against the Romans.
Wait, what was inscribed on the coin?
So it said year two of the freedom of Israel on one side of the coin, and on the other was a palm tree with the word Jerusalem. And this is apparently the only coin that's on record from this period of revolution to bear the name Jerusalem. So archaeologists and historians, you know, they know about this. They know about this rebellion that took place, you know, against the Romans. But seeing just this object from that time, there's a sense of this bringing history to life, which is just one of the things about archaeology that I think is just so amazing, that even objects that are so ordinary can just, you know, have just instantly, you know, collapse the distance between the past and the present, and just really, you know, make things seem so much more real.
Yeah, and it's incredible that so much history can be encapsulated by something so small.
I know. And the thing is, like, you know, I mean, compared to the Antikythera mechanism. I have to say that a few times to make sure I'm getting it right. I mean,
Yeah, you're saying it better than me.
I doubt that. but this, it's like, this is this incredible standalone object, you know, and then compared to it, it's just this, you know, like, for example, it's just this one tiny little coin, but you know, both of them are just these, you know, I think are representative of this, the different aspects of the past that archaeology brings back to life. What are some other fantastic discoveries?
Cool archaeological discoveries and mysteries. Well,
yes,
I was going to say that on sort of the opposite end of this tiny spectrum of a coin encapsulating a lot of history, another pretty mysterious and amazing discoveries was that of the Terracotta Army. And so workers digging in a well in 1974 in China came upon what is now known as the Terracotta Army. And it's thousands of life-size warriors, and they're made of terracotta, and they're standing ready to fight in three pits, sort of guarding the mausoleum or the tomb of China's first emperor.
That's a pretty impressive display.
Right. And these date back to between 259 BC and 210 BC. So these are really old. It's the largest of the three pits covers an area of three football fields. So this is like a humongous, I mean, this went hidden until 1974.
That's amazing that something so big could just have stayed, you know, just flown under the radar, so to speak. But what were they there for? What do archaeologists think was the purpose of this army?
So there's about, so far they've dug up, well, so far they've only dug up 2,000 of what they think are about 8,000 of these figures that apparently were to serve the emperor in his afterlife. So it's not just soldiers, it's archers, it's cavalry, chariots, all of this. It's as if he brought this humongous army into his afterlife.
That's pretty amazing.
Archaeologists aren't sure, but the figures seem to be specific soldiers, so they all have different hair. They all have different facial expressions. You know, many have different hairstyles. They have top knots. They have goatees. Some are wearing loose tunics. Some are wearing armor. They have different postures, different physical builds, and so
yeah, that's amazing that level of detail went into not just creating this army, but making each individual soldier, you know, an individual.
Well, yeah, and you think about today, if anything is going to be produced on that kind of scale, it would be mass produced,
well,
you know,
yes.
3D printed or something. And so scientists are still trying to figure out how each of them was crafted, basically, and whether they do represent individual soldiers. So that is a mystery, and it might continue to be a mystery because the emperor's tomb apparently is booby-trapped.
Oh, okay.
And so Han Dynasty historians said that it was booby-trapped, and basically that is keeping modern archaeologists away because they don't want to damage the site. And so a lot of the rest of this tomb might remain hidden, even though excavations are still ongoing there.
Right. So well, one of the ways that archaeologists piece together the past is by, you know, is looking at, you know, looking at objects and artifacts that were left behind, and that gives them clues about how people may have lived. And, you know, in cases like this, something like, you know, an enormous terracotta army that was created was obviously clearly something that was meant to glorify the emperor, this tomb that they were placed in.
Yeah, exactly. I think this would be an incredible archaeological site to visit.
Oh, yes, definitely. but another aspect of archaeology is looking at the human remains themselves. So from the way that, you know, from the postures that bodies, you know, that bodies were placed in when they were buried, to the number of people that were buried in a tomb, to the, you know, like the objects that they were buried with, or, you know, the ways that, you know, just that tells people about, you know, that tells people that are studying, you know, studying archaeology today about rituals from the past, about culture, about social groupings, about social status. And so there's a lot that, in archaeology that also comes from looking at, you know, literally looking at the human element of it. And the remains of people.
And usually you're talking about skeletons, like skeletal remains.
Well, not only. Obviously, skeletal remains are a big part of the archaeological record, but there are other types of human remains. Obviously, you know, Egyptian mummies and mummies from other cultures in South America, you know, those are very well known. And actually, mummification is something that was practiced in different parts of the world, just, you know, depending on the local climate and also just depending on local customs and cultures. But they're also one of my favorite areas of archaeological study are the bog bodies. These are bodies that were sort of naturally mummified by preservation in bogs and, you know, these kind of swamps. And because of the unique chemical composition in the bogs and the oxygen lack of oxygen. Yes,
right.
Thank you. These bodies are just preserved in incredible detail, to the point where, you know, the skin is really smooth and you can see details of the expressions and fingernails, and it's absolutely astonishing stuff.
And a little bit creepy.
Well, I don't know. Okay, yeah, maybe it's a little bit creepy. But, and you know, obviously humans aren't the only things that are preserved in bog environments. In fact, it was just a few years ago, I think, that archaeologists reported that they had retrieved what they were calling bog butter from one bog site. So this was actually like, and they think that because, you know, because these swampy environments were also kind of cold, that, you know, someone over 1,000 years ago probably thought this was a good place to store their butter, and it was left there and it was preserved. And I don't know if anyone actually tasted the bog butter. I know there was a lot of talk about that, but it was incredibly well preserved, to the point where it seemed like there was a chance it could be edible. But I would not volunteer to taste the bog butter.
I would not either, even though definitely bogs are incredible places for sort of holding off decomposition and keeping things in their pristine condition. So, you know, the bog people divulge quite a bit of information because they're so well preserved and in the state that they were placed in however many years ago. But another archaeological discovery might never be resolved.
And what is this?
This is the Voynich manuscript. And I'm sure you've heard of this. And it's a book that literally nobody can read. It's gorgeous. It was discovered in 1912 by an antique bookseller. It's about 250 pages. And it's written in an unknown alphabet with these gorgeous images, you know, that range from female nudes to medicinal herbs to zodiac signs. And the illustrations are really gorgeous in it, but nobody has yet to really decipher much of it.
Okay, so this is a manuscript. This is something that was written sometime during the Renaissance era.
Yes, exactly. Well, they think that it was written during the Renaissance era. Exactly.
Okay. Now obviously, you know, archaeologists that study ancient civilizations are often interpreting languages that have not been written or spoken for, in some cases, thousands of years. And there's been some success in many of these areas. This is a book that was written, you know, but comparatively just a few hundred years ago.
Right.
Why is this so hard to crack?
Apparently the words, the letters, it's an alphabet that is not known to anyone. And, you know, it's so unintelligible that some have said that it's written in an unknown language, and others, it's an actual code. And others say that it's a hoax, of course. But in 2014, Stephen Bax, who is a professor of applied linguistics at the University of Bedfordshire in England, said that he had deciphered 14 characters. And basically, he looked at known words, you know, of like planets and things like that, and then was able to sort of figure out the characters within those words, you know, like proper nouns. And so he said he, from those 14 characters, he was able to read some of the words for coriander, for juniper, and these were next to the drawings of plants. But overall, since 1912, the manuscript remains largely unreadable.
Well, and I guess one of the advantages of working of archaeologists that archaeologists have when they're working with maybe other examples of texts from civilizations where the languages are, you know, are no longer being used, is that they have more than one example to look at.
Exactly. And nothing to date has been found with this language, with this alphabet on it.
Okay. So this could also have just been some, you know, like some author illustrator who made up a language of their own and just put it all in this one book.
Perhaps, maybe, you know, like Pig Latin.
Right.
Just kidding. But it's pretty cool, and scientists continue to, you know, try to decipher this. So it's a serious endeavor for archaeologists who are interested in this field.
Okay. And then, you know, and then of course, you know, another that are, but archaeologists, you know, there are these like sort of individual puzzles that archaeologists can spend, you know, an entire career trying to unravel. But then of course there are, you know, there are much broader questions when you look at artifacts and, you know, and sites from ancient civilizations that are no longer around, is being able to see, well, you know, not only just how do these people live, but, you know, why did their civilization end? What happened to their society that these people are no longer around anymore? And potentially there may be lessons that we can take away from that today because,
exactly.
Because, you know, these things tend not to last forever. And the, you know, the biggest, most, you know, advanced, most complex societies of the past that are being studied by archaeologists today, they're no longer around. So for us to assume that was them and things are completely different now and that'll never happen to us is, you know, is probably giving ourselves too much credit.
Right. And one of the biggest mysteries in this area is the collapse of the Maya civilization.
Right.
And, you know, this civilization thrived for about six centuries and then it sort of just disappeared, or at least in one area around AD 900, it collapsed. And there are still some cities that continue to thrive, but overall, this civilization sort of did vanish.
So, and looking at the archaeological record, what do scientists think happened?
Well, they definitely think that drought played a role, and there were big droughts in Central America between about the year 800 and 900. Also, when the Spaniards took over, they brought diseases with them, and they forced the Maya to convert to Christianity, burning their books, you know, so not only killing them with diseases, but also forcing their culture to change. The jury's still out on exactly the nail in the coffin that caused this civilization collapse, but those are some of the ideas that scientists are finding as they dig up more Mayan sites.
Right, and there are new Mayan sites that are being discovered and being interpreted, so work that's still being done today is adding to what people know about it.
Exactly, and Life Science just recently covered the discovery of what is considered now the oldest and largest Maya monumental structure, and that dates between 1000 and 800 BC. And it surprised archaeologists because it pushes back when they thought the Maya were building these large structures, these large monuments with pyramids. And so it suggests they were perhaps more complex further back in time. Or more sophisticated.
Right, right. And then, of course, speaking of time, you know, many people know about the Maya calendars. And this is, you know, this is also something that the civilization is known for that people are still studying today.
Right. I mean, their calendars are fascinating. They have apparently three types of calendars. They had this 260-day sacred calendar. They had a 365-day secular calendar. And then the really interesting one is the long calendar. And dates for this, you know, we write our dates out as the month, day and year. And dates for this calendar were written out with 5 numbers and they were separated by 4 periods. And so archaeologists have figured out what each of those numbers represented. And more recently, a group of people decided that this long calendar was predicting a doomsday would happen on December 21st, 2012.
So how did that work? how did they get there?
Okay, so one of the numbers in this long calendar is called the Baktun, and it lasts 144,000 days, or just about 400 years. And for the Maya, that was considered a full cycle of creation. So doomsday comes in sort of okay. Oddly, but basically December 21st, or it could have even been December 23rd or 24th, but people in today's culture latched onto the December 21st, and that marked the end of the 13th Baktun. And from there, the doomsday message took off. And that was huge. I mean, Life Science, of course, covered that, and we're all still here. But it's just interesting how something from so long ago still manages to kind of affect culture today or impact culture.
We are just barely, I mean, you know, archaeology involves digging, and we are just barely scraping the surface here just some of the, you know, some of the mysteries and some of the amazing sites that are out there.
Right. You know, you have the Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, which is considered the oldest place of worship, and it might be the world's oldest temple. And that is steeped in mystery as well, you know, whether it really is that old or whether it is the oldest temple. There was an ancient copper scroll discovered at Qumran, which is where the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. And basically, this scroll could be describing a hoard of gold and silver, but no one knows where the treasure might be or even if it exists.
Very buried treasure. Yes, that's always and then, of course, you know, the Ark of the Covenant, which anybody who has seen the Indiana Jones movies knows about the Ark of the Covenant.
Yes.
Right. And so this is the large box that is supposed to hold the broken pieces of the Ten Commandments, which, because, you know, after Moses received the commandments, he, you know, like, he came back down and he saw that he had left, you know, the people he had left behind had made a golden calf. And he was like, "You idiots!" And he broke the tablets. And so it's a whole long story. I learned about it in Hebrew school. And
I love it.
The broken, but so, you know, but they couldn't. And then, you know, then after, you know, he went back and got 10 more, you know, 10 more commandments on new tablets. But, you know, of course, they couldn't get rid of the broken pieces of the old ones. So they put them, supposedly, they were kept, and they were, you know, presumably preserved in this box where they were carried around. And then this box was kept at the first temple in Jerusalem, which was then destroyed by the Babylonian army in 587 BC. And no one knows what happened to it after that. But whether or not it had superpowers and could, you know, melt Nazis' faces and stuff like that, yeah, that's
not a mystery.
Well, it's a mystery of movie magic, but not exactly of archaeology. So we talked about a lot of different examples of, you know, mysterious archaeology from all over the world, from, you know, all different time periods. But probably the one example that I think, you know, sort of looms the largest for most people is ancient Egyptian civilization.
And I think that's in part because we've studied them so much, but also everything is so well preserved. These monuments are so well preserved and they're so big, as you know, everyone knows.
Yes, yes. So, and of those, the monuments that kind of, you know, like, that just, you know, are the biggest, you know, the pyramids. These are incredible constructions that are hundreds of feet tall. They're made of millions of blocks of limestone. They weigh millions of tons. And so just the very idea of an ancient civilization constructing things like that, you know, not just once, but multiple times without using modern technology is just, you know, is kind of mind-boggling.
It really is. And they're not just, these pyramids aren't just huge on the outside. They're intricate. You know, scientists are finding that there's passageways, burials, you know, inside of these pyramids, and these icons of ancient Egypt. They're just incredible. Feats of, you know, architecture of construction.
Yeah, they were just, you know, it's like, and it's you know, they look fairly simple on the outside, but inside,
right,
they were just
right.
Amazingly complex.
So that brings us to today's mystery. How were the Egyptian pyramids built? So what are the biggest and best known pyramids? the ones that we see in images that people, you know, think of ancient Egypt.
Yeah, I think anytime, you know, like if you're seeing just a sort of a, you know, if there's any kind of generic discussion of, you know, of pyramids, you're usually going to see a picture of the three pyramid complex at Giza. So the biggest of these is the Great Pyramid. This was built by the pharaoh Khufu, whose reign started around 2551 BC. And today, there's been some erosion, obviously, since it was built. But today, it stands 455 feet tall, so 138 meters. Then the next biggest was built by the pharaoh Khafre, whose reign started in 2520 BC. So it's a little smaller than Khufu's, but it's on higher ground. So, you know, it seems like it's, yeah, so you know, it doesn't seem like it's that much smaller. And then the third pyramid at Giza was built by the pharaoh Menkaure, I believe is how the name is pronounced. And his reign started around 2490 BC. And his pyramid, which is kind of the baby of the bunch, is just 215 feet or about 65 meters high.
I love that. That's the baby pyramid.
The baby, yeah. little cute little baby. One. Yeah.
And so when did they start? When did Egyptians start building these monuments?
Well, this is actually a process that developed over centuries. So you know, these sort of mighty pyramids like the ones at Giza had very simple origins. So they originated as these rectangular tombs, mastaba tombs is what they were called, that were first found in Egypt dating to about 5,000 years ago. And then the earliest pyramids in Egypt, which were step pyramids, so they were graduated, not like the smooth-fronted ones that we see that, you know, survived to this day. So the earliest known step pyramid belonged to the pharaoh Djoser, whose reign started around 2630 BC and was built at Saqqara. And so that actually started as one of those very simple rectangular tombs, the mastaba tombs, and then was developed into a sort of a six-layered step pyramid, and that was like you were saying before, this was very complex with underground tunnels and different kinds of chambers.
After that, then they transitioned to making the smooth-edged ones, the smooth-edged pyramids,
the smooth faces. Yeah. So the next So the next big leap forward was by architects for the pharaoh Snefru, whose reign started around 2575 BC. And under him, at least three pyramids were built. And around, this is around the time where the pyramid construction, where archaeologists see that there was a transition from building step pyramids, which, you know, were probably a little bit, you know, like a little less complicated to construct, to the smooth faced ones. But at the time they were still figuring out the process. And in fact, one of the Pharaoh Snefru's pyramids that was built at Dashur is actually, it's sort of bent. So you can see the angle of the incline chain. It kind of changes partway up. So they didn't quite have all the bugs worked out. They were sort of still figuring that out as they went.
And I wonder if they didn't notice until it was done, because it's this huge thing you're working on. But anyway,
I think it's one of those things where probably, like, once they got to the point where it was happening and it wasn't quite lining up, I they were like, well, we've come too far. You know, it's not like you can tear it all down and start from scratch. So they're probably just like, we're just going to keep going.
And one of the things I love about these is that these pyramids were built as monuments to pharaohs. And often when we write about these, we say these pyramids were built by pharaoh such and such. But we know that the pharaohs themselves could not have built these pyramids. So who was in charge of all the builds and who actually did the work?
Right. Even though the pharaohs were the ones that were sort of being commemorated by them, and, you know, these pyramids were sort of, you know, like an emblem of their everlasting glory. You know, no, they were not like the work foreman. They weren't they weren't telling people what to do. So archaeologists are still piecing the process together, because obviously there was a lot of, you know, very complicated planning that had to happen ahead of time to build not just the pyramids, but also, you know, the temples and the pits and the cemeteries that were nearby. And so, you know, so there's the pyramids themselves, there were internal structures and chambers within the pyramids, and then there were usually other buildings that were just part of the complex. So this was usually some high-ranking official that was appointed by the pharaohs to oversee the construction, and there was probably, you know, quite a bit of nepotism involved here, as described in papyri found in 2010 at the site of Wadi al-Jarf on the Red Sea. So this is dating to the reign of Khufu, and there was text on the papyri that said that in the 27th year of the pharaoh's reign, his half-brother, someone named Ankhaf, was the vizier who is the highest official to serve the king in ancient Egypt. And archaeologists who wrote about this said that he was chief for all the works of the king. So that would seem to imply that Ankhaf was in charge of the construction of the pyramids.
And he was the half-brother of the pharaoh.
Yes, so. Exactly. So, you know, he probably had, like, you know, he had a foot in the door beforehand.
Right. And these just seem like such huge undertakings. I get, so they appoint someone who's like has this idea of and is going to oversee the building, but how did it actually take place? How did it, you know, did they have blueprints and how did they go from nothing to having this huge monument?
Well, this
on the ground.
Yeah, this is one of the sort of enduring mysteries, because even though there are some papyri that have details about aspects of the pyramid construction, there are, you know, no engineering plans have survived. So archaeologists and engineers have had to sort of, you know, reverse engineer the process just based on what few clues that they have and what they, you know, like just what is generally understood about engineering principles and what's involved in moving just, you know, large block, like millions of blocks that weigh, you know, like to build something that weighs millions of tons. So,
right, which hasn't changed over the years, the physics there.
No, physics are physics. So someone who, you know, someone from an engineering background, you know, could potentially look at, you know, look at the structure and be able to propose some, you know, some ideas for how this might have happened. So, but one thing that is known about the planning stages of these is that the ancient Egyptians were able to align these structures so that they were aligned to true north. And they did it with just this incredible degree of precision. And so, and being able to calculate that was obviously played an important part in planning where the pyramids and all the structures around them, how they were going to be oriented and where they're going to be relative to each other.
So how close to true north did they get it? I mean, has someone looked into that?
Really, really close. Yes. And in fact, an engineer named Glenn Dash, he studies the pyramids of Giza as part of the Ancient Egypt Research Associates. He noted that Khufu's pyramid is aligned to true north within 1/10 of a degree. Really close.
That's just incredible, because it was so long ago that they could do that. And so do we know, or do we have any idea how the ancient Egyptians went about aligning the pyramids?
Well, we do know that you know, ancient civilizations have been, you know, there's evidence that the sun or bright stars like Polaris were used for aligning structures or for the performance of certain rituals. But in 2016, this engineer, Glenn Dash, he conducted experiments using some fairly low-tech equipment, basically a rod, a wooden platform, and shadows to demonstrate how you could achieve that level of precision with fairly simple tools. So, and what he did was he put the rod on a platform, and then on the day of the fall equinox, he measured where the shadow fell, where the tip of the shadow was over the course of the day. And then he wrote that on the equinox, the surveyor will find that the tip of the shadow runs in a straight line and nearly perfectly east-west.
Oh, so that they could align that.
Yes.
To find north.
Right.
Okay.
So he pointed out that was, you know, we don't know for sure, but he said that was, you know, that's one method that where the tools would have been available to the ancient Egyptians, and it would have given them just this incredible precision. As far as, and because the equinox is, you know, is a specific date that you can pinpoint on a calendar, that's something that they could have worked around. And then if, you know, as long as they had, you know, as long as the day wasn't overcast, then they would have been able to do this.
So we don't have engineering plans, but we've done some reverse engineering and we figured out sort of some of the ways they planned to build pyramids. But, you know, what kind of labor went into actually the construction of the pyramids?
Well, there was a lot of labor.
Right.
So there by modern estimates, the pyramids at Giza likely required more than 10,000 people to actually physically put these three structures together. And so Giza was a port city. And so there are ancient records inscribed in papyrus that mention that limestone blocks were shipped to the pyramid site by boat. And from other evidence, by all accounts, it seems like the people that were working on this were apparently very well taken care of. So there was a study that was published in 2013 where archaeologists looked at the animal bones and remains that were preserved in sites at Giza. And so they were able, from looking at that, they were able to estimate how many animals were being consumed. And then by comparing that to what the nutritional requirements were for a person who was doing very hard, you know, very hard labor, they found that there were enough cattle and sheep and goats being slaughtered around Giza every day to produce 4,000 pounds of meat on average to feed the people wow. that were building the pyramids.
That's incredible. To do this work would have been just backbreaking, kind of, you know, and just very slow to bring these slabs of stone or limestone across, you know, on boats. So this was obviously a really important undertaking. And this is just one sign that, you know, they fed them well. These were important mm-hmm. workers doing important work.
And this might have actually been something that inspired local people to want to be a part of this project, because, you know, if they right. were being really well fed, that was probably better food than most people in the local villages were getting on a daily basis.
Right. And you mentioned limestone. So do we know where the stones came from for the pyramid?
Well, that's because archaeologists are able to do chemical analysis of stones. They're able to match the stones that are in the pyramid using their sort of geochemical fingerprints to stones from other locations, and to be able to say, oh, okay, it looks like these, you know, the stones that were used in the structure here, geochemically, they're a close match to stones in this location. So that's probably where the stones came from. And so doing that, they were able to find quarries that were located to the south of two of the Giza pyramids, where they can say with a fair degree of certainty that that's where these stones came from. The third one, Khafre's pyramid, it's still unknown what quarry was used for that one.
Cool. And so I think one of the big things that people wonder about, especially me, is these blocks were huge. They had to right. somehow move them
yep.
and get them into place, you know, hundreds of feet above them. Mm-hmm. And do we know about how that worked?
Well, they're actually illustrations. There are scenes in ancient artwork, not only that show these stones being, you know, piled up on sledges and being pushed or pulled by workers, but they also show water being poured in front of the sledges. And so, and engineers and physicists say that this is something, you know, this would have, by dampening the sand in front, this would reduce friction. And so there was a study that was published in 2014 in the journal Physical Review Letters, where these physicists demonstrated that pouring the sand, like wetting the sand down in front of these sledges, would have reduced the number of people you need to pull it by half. So they would have piled these heavy stones up on these giant sleds and then pushed or pulled them. And then probably, you know, to try and, you know, reduce the drag, they would have poured water in front to just make it move faster. And then once they got the blocks to the site, then they would use ramps to haul the stones up.
Oh, gosh, that's incredible. And so what do we know about the ramps?
Do we have evidence?
are any, you know, remains of the ramps left that we've seen?
No, there's very little evidence of those ramps, and so Egyptologists are not sure how those ramps were designed, but there have been several hypothetical designs that have been proposed.
Interesting. So that will remain a mystery. And what about, you know, what are scientists doing now to unlock more secrets, you know, about how these pyramids were created and constructed?
Well, there's actually a partnership called the Scan Pyramids Mission, which is a collaboration between researchers at universities, at the Heritage Innovation Preservation Institute, and the Egyptian Ministry of Antiquities. And what scientists are doing is they're scanning and restoring the Giza pyramids using a variety of different technologies. And so what this may do is this may just give them more information to work with to try and figure out how these pyramids came together. But also this could help them find chambers within the structures that haven't been discovered yet. So there may still be aspects of you know, what's going on these pyramids on the inside that still remain to be discovered.
So when these scanning projects are done, perhaps the last details of these pyramids' mysteries will be revealed.
Underwater archaeology is helping historians put together missing pieces of a grim chapter in human history, the transatlantic slave trade era. From 1525 to 1867, more than 12 million African people were abducted and enslaved. About 1,000 of the ships carrying enslaved people were lost at sea, and a partnership called the Slave Wrecks Project brings together archaeologists, historians, educators, and diving professionals to find and study these lost ships. Here to talk to us about that is Steve Lupkeman, a maritime archaeologist and the co-founder and international coordinator of the Slave Wrecks Project. Also here today is Jay Hagler, dive training coordinator for the Slave Wrecks Project and the lead instructor and safety dive officer for the marine archaeology nonprofit Diving with a Purpose. Steve and Jay, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Steve, before the Slave Wrecks Project, what was known about sunken ships that were used to transport enslaved people out of Africa?
So there's been a lot of work that was done by historians over the last 30 or maybe 40 years trying to better understand the history and the experience of the Middle Passage. But in archaeology, actually very little had been done even 15 years ago, which is one of the reasons that several of us who work in maritime archaeology came together and decided to start the Slave Wrecks Project. Arguably, it's probably the most important, historically significant maritime-mediated event in history. And yet, at the time when we started the project or started to think about the project, fewer studies had been done fewer efforts had ever been undertaken to try to identify and do work on these shipwrecks or try to preserve them than had been done in, say, you know, Cogs and Bogs in northern, in Ireland. And this spoke to the need to address this enormous gap in our knowledge, but also in terms of highlighting this important episode that shaped so much of the modern world in the Americas, but globally as well.
What were the goals of the project when it was founded in 2008, and how has it expanded in scope since then?
The project really started first in Africa, with a focus in South Africa and then in Mozambique. And we continue to be active in those two theaters. But over the last 6 or 7 years, we have expanded the project so that it's come back across the Atlantic. We have collaborators and we're working in places in the United States, such as down in Alabama, but other searches as well. And then also globally. So we have projects under development in places like Brazil and Cuba, but also elsewhere in Africa, on the West Coast, for example, in Senegal, and a number of other places. So it's grown from a project that started in Southern Africa to a project that now is global in scope.
Jay, when and how did you become involved with the Slave Wrecks Project?
Yes, well, I am a lead instructor and director of an organization called Diving with a Purpose. And Diving with a Purpose is a community-focused nonprofit organization dedicated to the conservation and protection of submerged heritage resources. Now, we do this by providing education, training, certification, and field experience to adults and youth in the field of maritime archaeology and ocean conservation. Now, we have a special focus of the protection, documentation, and interpretation of African slave trade shipwrecks and the maritime history and culture of African Americans. So that's where we, you know, kind of connected with the Slave Wrecks Project and Steve Lufkerman.
Jay, how do you train divers to do this type of archaeological work, and how is that different from training recreational divers?
First, you have to have kind of a fundamental skills in scuba diving. So we don't teach scuba diving there. We actually have a training course that we conduct every year in Florida. And this training course is a field school in which what we do is teach the fundamentals of underwater archaeology. And so what does that mean? It simply means we teach the skills to certified divers of how to actually measure and document artifacts of a ship. So this is a week-long, very intense training process. And the results of the training is that you come out with not only a certification in survey diving, but you also understand the fundamentals of how to document remnants of a shipwreck while underwater. And all that data becomes a site plan for the archaeologist to interpret, and actually, you know, it becomes a part of the record of the shipwreck.
What are the challenges of performing underwater archaeology?
Well, there are challenges and there are advantages. Maritime archaeology is a process, and you know, Jay has just described the training that Diving with a Purpose provides, which is really an essential first step. So what we always try to do first is to what we call non-destructive surface documentation. This is prior to any more advanced form of archaeological investigation that might involve a more complex excavation or the removal and conservation of actual objects. First and foremost, you want to document what's there without disturbing it. And this is what DWP has played a role in training folks who dive to work with archaeologists. Now, it really depends on the site. You know, some sites are very benign. You could be working in, you know, 25 feet of water and crystal clear, as in Mozambique. I've worked with Jay on several projects there. And then in other cases, you could be in 30 feet of water in which it's ice cold and it feels like you are, you know, in the middle of a washing machine being battered back and forth by different waves like we have in Cape Town in South Africa. So one of the real key challenges is that it's a dangerous environment. It can be a dangerous environment. It's an environment, you know, in which you're breathing compressed air and having the dive safety protocols and having people who know how to, you know, to work in that environment and can keep eye on safety is vital. I mean, this is one of the reasons that the work that Jay does as, you know, a dive safety instructor is so key on these sites. It's easy to get distracted and you need to pay attention. As you get into deeper sites, of course, the diving gets more and more challenging, you know, but it really depends on each site.
Jay, could you elaborate on why Mozambique was an important location on the slave trade route? And is there anything in particular about the waters around Mozambique that affect diving to investigate these wrecks?
Mozambique actually was an epicenter for the global slave trade, you know, on the east coast of Africa. That if you think about it as kind of a grand central station in which the slave trade went into the Indian, over the Indian Ocean, so there was a trans-Indian Ocean slave trade as well as a transatlantic slave trade. Mozambique became a focus of attention based upon a ship that we, as a Slave Wrecks Project, documented, discovered and documented in Cape Town, South Africa, called the São José, which is one of the inaugural exhibits in Smithsonian Institute's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Well, that ship, the São José, actually originated in Mozambique, so Mozambique Island. And that area, there are multiple ships that were involved in the global slave trade that was in Mozambique Bay, all right, Mozambique Island. So that's kind of the general historical significance, and Steve can get more into detail. Now, relative to the diving, it becomes a very interesting dive environment because there's an actual fort that is end of the island of Mozambique Island, Ilha de Mozambique is what it's called, the island of Mozambique. And that fortress served as literally just that, a fortress that guarded precious cargo, which was human cargo that was involved in the global slave trade. So as you can well imagine, outside that fort, that is the ocean currents, the Indian Ocean, and as a matter of fact, the Madagascar Channel. So you have very strong currents. We have very unpredictable conditions underwater. Now, within the bay, it's calmer because it's protected. It's literally protected by the surrounding area. So that's calmer. So there are ships that are both inside the bay and outside the bay. And the water conditions are much different. Inside the bay, it's much calmer. It tends to have a clearer visibility. And outside the bay becomes actually more turbulent, and there are deeper wrecks. So the functional areas in which the trade actually worked, where ships were outside the bay, and then there was ship that was inside. And there was, you can imagine, there was a transport system in getting enslaved Africans from the land to the ships and then off to their destination. So relative to a diving perspective, it's very important. Clarity, visibility, and currents become very important factors in dive safety and then documentation. As Steve said, is that it's important of non-destructive documentation. So we are not lifting the artifacts. We are documenting them in place, what's called in situ. And in certain cases where we deem that, you know, this is an artifact that needs further examination, then we may excavate. So as Steve was saying, there are different conditions, different situations. And in Mozambique, we have actually a broad spectrum of conditions from calm water to actually what we call turbulent water. And that's kind of where the fun begins.
So, Steve, how do you identify where to look for shipwrecks of slave ships?
One of the things we tend to think about is, coming here in North America and in the Caribbean, the vast majority of people who were enslaved did come, in fact, from West Africa. But, you know, as the West African trade was being closed down, mostly because of in the early 1800s, because of the British blockade and the British efforts at abolition, East Africa became a new source in which, so slavers not being able to do as much as they would have liked to in West Africa, began to shift over to East Africa. And in fact, many ships during this time, ironically enough, used the American flag because it was the one flag after the War of 1812 that the British would not intercept. So they might take on a cargo in a place like Mozambique or in Zanzibar under a Portuguese flag or a Brazilian flag, and then fly under an American flag as they were crossing the Atlantic in order to evade the British en route to places like Brazil or Cuba in particular. You know, so the East African trade, which is far less known and has fewer people, less than a million would have come from, which is still an enormous number. It probably prolonged the African slave trade by another 30 or 40 years beyond what it would have been otherwise. So a place like Mozambique has connections to places in the U.S. I mean, the same year as Jay just mentioned, the San Jose, which was in 1794. The same year or within a year or two, we have evidence, you know, of ships coming in from places like Charleston and from Rhode Island and from Boston. The slave trade was a global enterprise. You know, the owners of the San Jose had connections and ties in 1794 in Brazil, in Angola, in Portugal, in India, in Goa. I mean, this is globalization, what, two centuries before Bill Gates. And it's important to understand how global this enterprise was and how much the modern world's sort of, you know, the building of the modern world depended on it. We forget this. So Mozambique is a good place to sort of bring this into relief and show how global the enterprise, in fact, was. You know, when it comes to research and how we find the ships that we're looking for, there are a variety of different ways. I mean, one of the things that I think is important is to realize you can go to the Transatlantic Slave Trade Database, which is a database that's been put together over the last, I'd say, 20 years by historians that is trying to document as many voyages of vessels that were carrying slave. And I think they have north of 30,000 voyages documented, which by some estimates is over half of all the voyages that were ever conducted. You know, and just in that database alone, there are over 1,000 verified shipwrecks. Now, they don't all tell us exactly what happened or where it happened, but some of them have more specific information. Sometimes there are communities that have a specific memory. If you go down to Mobile, Alabama, the Clotilde in Africatown is a community. This was the last known slave ship to arrive in America that has a living memory of, you know, that they of coming in and of where the ship might have been, and that aided, I think, the archaeologists in locating that. So it really varies. Sometimes it's very meticulous, detailed historical archival research that is coupled then with a pretty extensive and intensive field work that involves magnetometry and diving to try to discover where the ship is, which ship it is. It's a matter of careful research, sometimes oral history, a lot of work in dusty archives, and then a lot of work in the field trying to figure out which is which. But, you know, I think what can be said is that there's an enormous amount of work that can be done. The Slave Wrecks Project has you know, worked with its partners like DWP and Smithsonian and the U.S. Park Service and EZCO, the Museums of South Africa, to try to advance this. But, you know, we hope that many other groups and many other organizations will start to see how important this heritage is and this history is and get involved, because there's far more work to do than even a partnership as extensive as the Slave Wrecks Project is capable of carrying out. So we hope to catalyze interest in the field.
What would you say that projects like Diving with a Purpose and the Slavery Wrecks Project bring to the existing narrative about slavery? And what do they add to other types of historic records of the slave trade?
Well, the important part is that understanding your history gives you an understanding of what's going on in the present, and it's a window to what can occur in the future. So stories such as De Sao Jose are point of entrees to start to have the important discussion relative to North America and the United States, the important discussion that is going on today in the Black Lives Matters movement, you know, the race relations in America. But now it's also understanding that slavery is not a uniquely American, it's a global problem. And so identifying shipwrecks as well as aircraft wrecks that were involved in not only the slave trade, but has a deep history in American and global history is very important. It starts to begin as that point of entree to talk about race relations globally, race relations in the United States. You know, oppression and unjust treatment of African Americans. Shipwrecks, aircraft wrecks serves as this point in which it gives a historical context of racism against African Americans, which informs and enriches this conversation. So it's important, and it becomes a vector to so many different conversations, not only social things, but also careers. Careers on the ocean, careers in maritime archaeology. We need more people in these fields to continue to tell the story.
I've been talking to Steve Lupkeman and Jay Hagler about the Slave Wrecks Project and Diving with a Purpose. You can find out more about those organizations on their websites. The links are in the show notes.
Thanks for joining us today for Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. Today's archaeology mystery, How Were the Egyptian Pyramids Built?, is available as a Life's Little Mysteries article on our website, livescience.com.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter for even more Life's Little Mysteries and for the latest science news. You can also join the conversation in our Live Science forums, where you can pose Life's Little Mysteries questions of your own or even suggest topics for upcoming podcast episodes. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss out on new episodes.
What will we talk about next? It's a mystery.
Literally. It'll be another Life's Little Mystery.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audio Boom as part of their Audio Boom Originals Network.